Registry Matters is an independent production. The opinions and ideas here are that of the hosts and do not reflect the opinions of any other organization. If you have a problem with these thoughts, FYP. Recording live from FYP Studios East and West, and West times two, I guess, transmitting across the internet. This is episode 182 of Registry Matters. Larry, you know what? I was here last week. I was sitting right here waiting for you people, and you never showed up. What happened last week?
I celebrated my 177th birthday.
Does that make you old enough to have served in the Lincoln administration?
Well, actually, it does. I was the youngest Deputy Secretary of War that this country has ever had.
Wow. Oh, that's impressive. Good for you. Let's look, I won't even beat around the bush. We were super busy last week. There was I produced the conference that Narsal had last week. So time was really tight. It was your birthday. And then also, it was also Father's Day. So we just took the weekend off. Sorry for people that missed it last week. I got a bunch of messages from people saying, I didn't get the podcast yet. And I'm like, sorry, we didn't record one. But because of that, so we have extra content this week from stuff that may have rolled over from last week. And on top of it all, we have a guest joining us this week, someone that I've been interested in getting on for quite some time, but haven't ever gotten around to it. And we have Matt, who is the Outspoken Offender, joining us. Welcome, Matt. How are you tonight?
I'm doing well. Thank you for having me. I'm excited to be here.
Awesome. Do me a favor. Can you give me, so I've been following, maybe how long have you been on YouTube? For like a year, maybe 18 months or so that you've had some videos out where you were walking down the street saying, I'm trying to apply for a job.
Yeah, I think it's been about a year. I think some of the first videos that I did was me complaining more, and it's kind of morphed. But I think it's been about a year, and then I had a break in there. But it's been about a year or so. Let's see.
Okay.
I think the first video was.
Somewhere in that ballpark. I just remember seeing you walking down a street. I don't know where you were, but you would say that you were going on a job interview, and then you'd follow up and saying whether it went good or bad. You did a video that that we even covered on the podcast where you were calling around to apartment complexes asking if they would take what we call PFRs, which is person first to register. And so how did you decide to get things going?
With the YouTube channel, the whole thing? Well, you know, it's been a thought of mine for, I've been on the registry since 2012. And I've always been kind of an ambitious person, and I've always had a problem with people automatically assuming that people forced to register are dangerous, they can't be around children, you know, and all this. And you know, throughout the years, I've thought maybe it might be interesting, you know, am I brave enough to do a YouTube channel about a registrant, like the day in the life, kind of, you know, the experiences. And I don't think it may have been done before. I don't know. But that's, you know, that was kind of my thought. And I didn't do anything at the time. You know, I was married, you know, in a few years after I got out of incarceration. And, you know, I was focusing on different things. But it was always a thought in my head. And then when I moved up to the Pacific Northwest, I found myself to be in a good situation. I'm single. And what I mean by that is I'm not affecting like my family so much, you know. So I'm single, and I just like, you know what? I'm just going to start this. And I start talking about my experiences. And that's just how it started. I did it for a few months, and then I had to move, and life got crazy for a little bit, for about 5 or 6 months. I didn't do any videos. And then out of the blue, I logged into my YouTube account and saw that I had a several hundred followers. I'm like, wow. And so then I just started doing more videos. That's kind of how it all started.
Excellent. And what I think is super interesting, and certainly Larry, chime in, is that where you're very much focused on the stigma side of how are we going about living our lives, and while that's certainly important, Larry is like super duper focused on policy, and I'm much more like a data nerd kind of person. And I'm more interested in things on that side of things of like, how did we get here and how could we make it better? And I think that the two of our programs could coincide in happy spaces without a whole lot of conflict necessarily. What do you, fairly accurate, Larry?
I think so. I'd be delighted if we could figure out a way to work in collaboration.
What were you going to say, Matt?
Well, I think you're right. I you know, from time to time, I do talk about different laws and restrictions, and that's all in combination with, you know, the rejection, social ostracism, and things like that. I should have been a sociologist, I think, or a psychologist, because it's just a fascinating to me on how these laws and restrictions have come about, and the thinking of people that create these laws that make things worse. And so that's what I've been focusing more on, you know, especially housing and employment. And maybe because those two topics have really affected me personally. I'm sitting here and I'm not trying to whine or anything, but, you know, it's been hard to find employment. And we're looking at
definitely
my offense was in 2006. So,
yeah, totally. Yeah. Totally.
Mm-hmm.
All right. I think, is there anything else you want to, before we start running through all this stuff, is there anything else that you want to, like, could you really quickly give me a website, or a YouTube channel that people can go to find your stuff? I want you here for the whole program to chime in with any thoughts that you have, as we're going through.
Yeah, sure. If people want to learn more about me and what I've been doing and all the resources, you can go to the website. It's theoutspokenoffender.com.
Okay, cool. All right. Well, Larry, anything before we run things down?
Let's roll this train.
Excellent. First thing that I wanted, I found actually over on our Discord server, someone posted a little comic strip. Let me make sure that I leave this thing up there for a minute. Where'd it go? There it is. Hey, it says there's a little comic strip that's got four panels. It says, "Hey, did you see now that if you say offensive things about certain religious sects, they register your name on some list?" Really? Yep. You become a registered sex offender. All right, that was maybe a bad joke, but it was a joke nonetheless, and it had our word in there. Should we continue, Larry, or do you have something else?
Oh, let's roll the train.
You found us a little clip. This is post the Chauvin sentencing, which I don't think you thought he would get 22 and a half years, but Chauvin was, Derek Chauvin, the cop that put his knee in George Floyd's neck for 9.5 minutes. He was sentenced to 22 and a half years. That just came out in the last couple of days. Do you have any comments on that?
I sure do. I did not believe that he would be sentenced leniently. I think I poo-pooed the idea that his defense attorney strategy was good. In fact, I criticized it harshly that he blamed the system for what Mr. Chauvin did. I was very disappointed, and I said emphatically, if I had been consulted with him, I would have not advised that strategy. I think now we can see that strategy was not terribly effective. But in terms of what he was going to get, I figured he would get a harsh sentence. But 22 and a half years is adequate, I think. There will be people who will think it's not nearly enough, but he's going to be in solitary confinement for his safety, probably for the entire time he's incarcerated. And it's a very harsh sentence, but
that would be a long time to be in solitary. That would be a brutal amount of time to be in solitary.
Well, he could conceivably be out after 15 years, but that's a brutal amount of time. But we do have, I want to make some comments about the attorney general who directed the prosecution team on this. And we got a little clip here from 60 Minutes that aired. I'd like to play.
All right. Hopefully my tech will work.
Why would this officer assault George Floyd?
Well, that's a question we've spent a lot of time asking ourselves. And all we could come up with is what we could divine from his body language and his demeanor. And what we saw is that the crowd was demanding that he get up and that he was staring right back at them defiantly. You don't tell me what to do. I do what I
want. I get clipped off. He says, I do what I want. That is kind of amazing that would be the statement from the police.
So, yes, he said emphatically beyond that you people don't tell me what to do. And that was my point at that clip, is in fact, we people do tell you what to do. You're an employee of the people when you serve in a police capacity, a law enforcement capacity. And we, in fact, do and should tell you what to do. Now, through recent history, we've abdicated that responsibility, and we've allowed the police department to decide what they're going to do to decide what equipment they're going to use, to decide the tactics they're going to employ, to decide how they're going to interact with the public. And now I think that's beginning to finally change. The citizens are beginning to reassert their control over the police, and I believe this is potentially a 9/11 moment. And I'll explain that. Prior to 9/11, airline management emphatically trained their crew and personnel not to intervene, particularly, I'd say going back to the 1960s when we had a lot of hijackings to Cuba, and those hijackings went on to the 70s until aviation security increased. They went to Cuba, they paid their ransom, they returned, and everybody was safe. And that was what management instilled in terms of corporate responsibility. We do not become violent. We do what we're told. Well, after 9/11, that all changed. I think now that for the first time in Minnesota history, according to the AG, now that an officer's been convicted and given a reasonably long prison sentence, and the crowd sees that their failure to intervene resulted in the loss of a man's life because his life was snuffed out by a knee on his neck for, I think, 17 or 27 times he said, "I can't breathe." I believe now that perhaps the people will do what they have done many times since 9/11. They will actually intervene. If the officer doesn't take the knee off of the back, off of the neck, I believe the people will.
Matt, let me ask you a quick question. Can you imagine if somebody in the crowd would have done some charging and tackle Chauvin while he was doing that? Can you imagine what the response would have been from the police?
What was that?
If somebody in the crowd there would have charged after him and tackled him to get off of George Floyd's back, can you imagine what the response from the police would have been?
Oh yeah, I mean,
I'm thinking of a Rodney King kind of beating.
Yes, definitely. I mean, why? Oh, I don't know. If I was there. I say to myself, if I was there witnessing, I would have, if I heard that guy can't breathe, I would definitely have probably stepped up. I wouldn't have, probably tackled the police officer or anything, but I would have liked to think that I would have said something if I was there.
And people did, in fact, something. They said, "Get off of him." But that he defiantly looked at them and said, "I will not get off of them. You people don't tell me what to do." And that's why I'm saying I believe this is a game changer potentially. I believe that the people are recognizing that if you don't intervene, someone could die. And at the time that this started, there weren't that many officers there. Now, they would have called it a massive amount. If had there been citizen intervention, they would have called it a massive amount of resources. And there would have been a brutal put down. Absolutely. And we would not have known that if they had saved the man's life, we wouldn't have known what was happening. But now that people see that failure to intervene results in loss of life, I believe that they will intervene, just like they intervene on aircraft now when there's a disturbance. They make sure that they don't get flown into and become infernals after what happened in 9/11.
Yeah. All right. Larry, should we move over to the question from Brent?
Let's do it.
All right, here we go. This is a question from Brent.
Hey, Larry and Andy, I have a question for you people. So I had a relative that was arrested last Friday, I believe, by the FBI, and they refused to tell us where they were taking him. Eventually, we tracked him down and found that he was staying in a county jail. And we were wondering when he's going to get bonded out or, bailed out, because, they're holding him and there's a detention hearing scheduled June 29th. The charge that he's got two charges, possession and, or receipt and or distribution and possession. Can you explain what this detention hearing is and what we should expect? Because, shouldn't he just get bond? So, anyway, thanks, you guys. I listen to you every week and appreciate what you do. And FYP.
Wow, that's complicated, Larry. Where are you going with this?
Well, I thought since it is a sexual-related offense and it's federal, it gives us a chance to talk a little bit about the bail system that the federal government has. They were early on in the And federally, they reformed bail in 1964 and again in 1984. And the 1984 Bail Reform Act is what we're going to discuss. And in theory, the reforms done in 84 ended the practice of cash bail and mandated a defendant be released on his or her own personal recognizance. Unfortunately, as with most laws, this practice has not has not worked out as the people who proposed and advocated it had hoped. In the detention hearing he's mentioned is a provision of the Bail Reform Act of 1984. And since I don't know the specifics of this case, I would be hesitant to say much, but I can say the fact that the government is seeking detention is not a good thing. It means that they do not want him to be released pending trial. And under the Bail Reform Act, the preferred method is personal recognizance. And if they don't get personal recognizance, then there are other factors in play, because a detention hearing is required in cases that involving violence. That is not a violent crime, including offenses for the maximum sentence is life imprisonment or death. That doesn't apply in either of these charges, or in certain drug offenses for the maximum sentence is 10 years or more. None of that applies. But now this possession and distribution, he could be facing more than 10 years as a maximum sentence. But under the Bail Reform Act, a hearing is required for those certain defendants, and including those who have multiple convictions. But a hearing can be held if the government requests pretrial detention, which is apparently what they've done in this case. And they have to argue that there's a serious risk that the defendant will flee, or where it appears that the defendant will obstruct or attempt to obstruct justice or tamper with witnesses or jurors. If bail is denied in this case on the 29th, the judge must issue written findings of why, the reasons for the pretrial detention, and that order is immediately appealable. Now, this is where I get doom and gloomy. I have seen a number of those orders appealed, and I do not think in my memory I can come up with one where the detention has been overturned. So although it is appealable directly to the circuit court, you don't win those appeals. So I would suggest in this case that you do everything you can to cooperate with the attorney that should be trying to put together a release plan for the accused. And that means answering your telephones, because the people at pretrial service may be calling, the people at the Federal Public Defender's Office may be calling, and there might be phone numbers on your phone that you do not recognize. But there's only a very short period of time, and you need to get all the information to these people that, so that they can make a decision and make the best case on the 29th for the judge. That's what I would recommend.
I gotcha. Hang on one second, Larry. Matt got dumped out. He lost his power. Well, crap, that sucks. Our guest has lost power. He said, oh, I guess this is the heat wave. He's over on the West Coast. You can speak to that. So in his area, I guess they're doing rolling blackouts, so his power went out.
Now, you have to admit that that's funny.
I mean, considering like the time that we're recorded, it's like, hey, at this time, and like, oh, shit, the power goes out. All right, well, we will continue. Hopefully, he will come back, and we will get his comments and things as we roll. Well, God, all these bail bond thing hearings, it's pretty complicated, convoluted, and very, the word is esoteric because it's super specific. You have to be an expert in this field. It's not just stuff that the general population knows.
That is correct. And his family is thinking in terms of just going down and posting cash bond. That doesn't happen in the federal system. He'll be released on his personal recognizance, or he'll be released to a halfway house, or he'll be released to home detention with electronic monitoring, or he'll sit in jail. Those are his options. And since the government is seeking pretrial detention by requesting this hearing, because he's not in that group of mandated hearing as far as what I could see from the criteria, that means that they do not want him out.
Yeah, definitely. I don't think they want anybody out, Larry. They want if everyone were locked up, then there would be no crime on the streets.
You do have a point there.
All right, moving on to a question from Brian in Discord. It says, Andy, I seem to remember Larry having a very thoughtful explanation of the comparison between this and IML, along with the implications or that thereof. If this fails, is this from the South Carolina decision? I think. If it's possible to revisit this on Saturday, it seems to me that if this is allowed to stand, the states will pick this up broadly. But if it fails, then having our passports marked in this way could be impacted. Or maybe it just falls back to the state may mark any other of their official documents as they see fit.
I'm not clear on what this is that he's talking about.
God, I'm trying to remember too. We talked about something recently with something being marked. Didn't driver's license were being marked? Did we talk about that recently?
Well, we have talked about it recently. Louisiana has had a
That's
court
what it was
decision
then.
that they couldn't mark the licenses in the way that they were marking them, but that decision did not support that you can't mark them at all, just not the way they were doing it.
Right. Okay, that's totally what it was. And Brian is from Louisiana, and he was on briefly, but he works offshore and has no bandwidth to receive the podcast when we record it live. But he always shows up and tries. But yeah, so that's what he's talking about, the recent Louisiana case.
Well, as I think I recall, I think the legislation to mark them again died. I think that it's not a threat in this particular session, if I remember right. I think that it died.
So, and his question is that you having a very thoughtful explanation of the comparison between this and IML, along with the implications or that lack thereof, if it fails. And you're saying it did fail, right?
That proposal, as I understand it, did fail. But people, please understand, these folks don't give up. The legislature in Louisiana
Yeah.
will convene again. And the same person that made the proposal, if he or she is still in office, they're likely to bring this proposal back. They don't suddenly have an epiphany and say, gee, I had that wrong. I should never have offered that bill. Oftentimes, it takes many years to pass legislation. Very few things pass the first effort. They will bring that back again. I would not take your guard down. You need to be in tune with what they're doing in Baton Rouge because they're not going to give up after one attempt.
As I recall it, if we do talk about IML, the I can't remember, Smith is the name I remember from New Jersey. That got introduced a number of times until it made it through finally.
Correct. He proposed that probably for a decade.
Okay. He was working like almost his whole purpose of being in the Senate is to try and work that, try and get that legislation passed almost.
He was actually a House member, but yes, he did that for years.
Okay.
And it typically takes many years to pass legislation. There has to be something really enormous that passes on a first attempt, like the relief for the COVID. That was something. But normal things, tax reform, how many years did it take for the tax bill that they passed in 2017 that Trump signed? I'm not saying one way or the other what my position is, but that didn't happen overnight. They have been advocating, those who believe we can continue to cut taxes, they work on that. That's what they do. They believe that you should cut taxes. But that doesn't mean every time you put in a tax reduction proposal, it passes. There are people who believe you ought to raise taxes. There's going to be proposals in this administration to raise capital gains and taxes on certain people. Likely most of those won't pass. They will bring them back. They won't suddenly, after one failure, say, well, we had that all wrong. Of course we shouldn't try that again. They will come back and try it again, just as if people who want to mark driver's licenses will try that again.
Definitely. Let's move over to this quick question. It says, is there any way to create a class action lawsuit representing the spouses of PFRs that have lost their jobs or been forced to remove, et cetera, because of their spouse's status on the registry? So that would be the we people, and then our spouses are having problems with jobs or where they live, et cetera. I think we've talked about this, but what is your stance on why don't our friends, family, et cetera, file to get together to try and make some sort of class action lawsuit to do something to make their lives easier, but they shouldn't be punished for being associated with us.
Well, I agree with that in part. I'm not a big fan of class action lawsuits. They're too difficult to get a class certified, and they're too difficult to manage in most instances. A class action lawsuit, as I've said many times before, you don't just go down to the stationery supply store and get a big red rubber stamp that says class action and stamp it on a piece of paper and say this is a class action lawsuit. There are a lot of factors that you have to go through, hoops to jump through, to certify a class of people, and we won't spend a lot of time on it, but you have to have the class certified. And therefore, you can achieve the same objective without a class. And a similar thing was tried in Louisville, Texas, with spouses who were wanting to support a PFR, and there was nowhere in Louisville to live because of the residence restriction, and they were claiming that that impaired their relationship. That lawsuit was not successful at the trial court. It was not successful at the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals in New Orleans, where Texas resides in the Fifth Circuit, nor was a cert petition to the U.S. Supreme Court granted. Now, that doesn't mean that I pronounce on one attempt that it's a failure. I think there would be potential for development of the right type of lawsuit on behalf of spouses, and particularly minor children. I would say spouses and minor children are going to be far more sympathetic litigants than the PFRs themselves. We need to be creative. We need to come up with funding, and we need to come up with the right cause of action that's not already been foreclosed by adverse decisions. If you were to do a similar case in Texas, which is within the Fifth Circuit, every state in the Fifth Circuit that has residence restrictions is going to essentially be foreclosed by the Duarte decision that was made some years back.
So what is the angle? So I'm prevented from living at 123 Main Street, and my spouse at the time would say, or the landlord property owner says, no, I'm not going to rent to you because of your status. And the spouse then files, no, you can't do that. You can't restrict where I live. Can't the landlord go, I'm not restricting you from living there. I'm restricting that person from living there. You can live here all you want.
That would be correct in that scenario. But I was thinking more in terms of a different scenario. It would be like your kid saying that they were being emotionally harmed because their dad could not be on campus to support them like a normal dad would be. And okay, I think the kid would have standing. And that's what I'm saying, putting together the right cause of action with the right plaintiffs. The kid would be a very persuasive plaintiff when you say, hey, judge, I can't do these things. It hurts me. It hurts my chances for a scholarship. It hurts my chances for you name it, because my dad's not able to be a part of my life. That was more what I was thinking than what you came up with.
And in that sense, you can't pick your parents. You can certainly pick your spouse, but you can't pick your parents. You got to take whatever cards you're dealt at that time. I see where
that
you're going.
That is correct. Yep. So I think I would not rule this out, but the big thing that's always missing in this is funding, folks. Litigation drags on for years and years, and it costs gobs of money. And we don't have gobs of money, but guess who does? The defendants that we would be going after do.
Right. And probably, I don't know about on the kid side, if you start suing, do you school like a school board or something like that for not letting the PFR on campus to attend a game or something? Like you're suing, that would be a deep pocket, I would imagine.
That would be correct. Anytime you're bringing an action related to the registry, you're going to be fighting deep pockets, either state, local, or federal. There's going to be deep pockets. The government, whatever entity it is going to have far more funding than the average PFR is going to have. So collectively, I know this is a hard word for a lot of people to understand, but this is where we need collective contributions and collective resources, because the individual is greatly restricted in what they can do, but collectively we can do a lot of good things working together. What a concept, working together.
Stop it. Don't say those crazy things. Let's move on to this quick question. It says, to start, I plan to travel to the Caribbean, or is it Caribbean, Larry? Caribbean or Caribbean? By ship in 4 days. This will take place in 4 months. I have not traveled since leaving the military, which was during the President Obama signed the IML. I emailed the United States Marshals Service National Sex Offender Targeting Center. Good grief. My email is below, and they emailed me back very quickly. I want the group to help me respond. To me, the email I sent should have been cut and dry. Is there something missing here?
Well, the email's missing.
Okay. Is it a dump, or did I grab something wrong?
I'm not sure. Just keep going.
Okay. Oh, it says, okay. Well, I know Larry may say if you register in one state, you have to have to in another. Is that also related to this?
Yes.
Okay. When have I said this? But the state I live in says you are no longer required to register, regardless if Texas has placed you back on the registry. The state conveys that deferred adjudication is deferred, and once off, your obligations are no longer in our state. Our definition is almost like Texas's, and that's from Christian.
That's from Christian in Minnesota. And I just wanted to correct when he said Larry will say if you have to register one state, you have to have register another. Larry has never said that. Larry has said to the opposite. I have said that there are states who have that in their statute, but it's not me saying that. It's in their statutory scheme. If you have to register in one state, you have to register in another. In fact, I've said that oftentimes those are violative of the Constitution's Equal Protection Clause. So I'd appreciate that people, when they try to quote me, that they actually get it right. We've talked about cases where the Equal Protection Clause has held that you cannot simply require a person to register at one state because they had to register at another state. I think that was recently talked about out of Indiana. But what the main reason I put this in here is writing to the Marshals Service is not really the smart thing to do. What you have probably done now is put yourself in a database you don't want to be in, because I do have the email that they sent back, and they said, by the way, what states are we talking about? Give us specifics. And Texas may be listing him on their registry, but please trust me, folks, being listed on a registry is not the same thing as being registered. And for some reason, people roll their eyes, they tip their chairs backwards, and they make all kind of faces when I tell them that. When you are registered, you're reporting in, you're being fingerprinted, you're being photographed, you're being told you can't be here, you can't be there, you can't do this, you must do that, all these things. Texas is not telling him to do any of that stuff. They simply have a historical marker in place that he was there. And the same thing with Florida. When you leave Florida after you've been registered there, they don't tell you that you're restricted in any of your activities. They simply have marked your historical presence, and that's a historical fact that you were there. Is it not?
Seems like it. They're stating a fact that you were once in this state. They're not saying you are currently in the state. They're saying you were once stated that way.
That is not the same thing as being registered or having the prohibitions associated with registration imposed upon you. My understanding, and I'm qualifying this by saying I don't know that I have the full understanding. My understanding is if you're not actively registered in a state, and being listed on a website is not actively registered. I mean, when you're actively registered, they have entered you into the NCIC, whatever the registrar is that's taken your registration. They put you into the NCIC, and you're in that database as a registered person. My understanding is, and I know this may not be correct, but that's what's used for international travel notifications. I'm not of the opinion that it's simply being listed on a website. There are people that are dead that are listed on websites. It's a historical fact that they were alive at one time and they were registered there. I'm not sure that it works off of the public listings. So in this particular instance, since he's not registered anywhere, he's merely listed on the Texas website, I do not believe he has any obligation to report it, the travel, because here's the problem. If you're not registered, there's no one to report it to. You have to report it to your registering agency, which transmits it to the Marshals Service, who transmits it internationally. If you don't have a registrar, who would you report the information of the international travel to?
Now, you know, Larry, our people are going to go find, track down that person, go register with.
Our people are going to do what?
They're going to go find the person that they would go register with and tell them that they're going to go travel. Just like the people in North Carolina that, being told they don't have to register, they go back and go, are you sure I don't have to register? Our people are going to go back to that same registration person and say, hey, I'm going to go on this cruise. Is there a problem? And they're going to go transmit the information.
So, well, I think Christian listens to us, and I would be interested to hear what transpires on this. But my fear is he put himself in a position he doesn't want to be in, because it's those type of communications that causes them to go to lawmakers and say, oh, we've got a gaping loophole here.
All right. So, but back to your point, though, is once you are no longer actively registering, most people, I think, is something of a yearly interval. Maybe it's quarterly. Maybe it's every couple of years or something like that. Once you don't have that duty to register, who would you tell you are traveling out of country? Excuse me.
I'm at a loss to know who you would report the travel to.
It's super interesting. That's super bizarre. So now all of a sudden you just sort of become like a normal person again. How weird. When did that happen, Larry? When did you become like a normal person again?
So strange.
I know. Another question comes in. It says, I was recently asked what notice is required for out-of-state travel. This sounds really similar. Ohio requires 20 days advance notice of change of residence, which is defined to include a temporary domicile occupied for 3 days or more. I've always been of the opinion that includes travel for 3 days or more. I now have reason to believe either that I'm interpreting this provision too narrowly or the county sheriffs are not enforcing it correctly. Since we're talking about Ohio, we were experiencing this when we had the conference there a couple of years back.
Yeah, this was posted on the listserv by an Ohio last week, and it generated so many responses that my server crashed. But this is one of those things where we honestly don't know the answer to it. No one can give you the answer to this. The law says that I didn't put everything in there, but a temporary domicile, my opinion is that law was written to encompass when you change your residence. A vacation is not a change of residence. So therefore, I don't believe there's a duty to give that notice. I believe the notice applies, a 20 days advance notice of a change of residence. And visiting another state is not a change of residence. But you can read it the way this person's reading it. And some sheriffs apparently are reading it this way. It's kind of like the provision in New Mexico law that says you shall register within 10 days of being released from a correctional jail facility or jail. Well, if you've been registered all along and you go into jail for a weekend and you bond out Monday morning, there'd be no reason for you to register because you were already registered. That was written prior to when we first enacted the registration in 95, and it was encompassing the people when they first get convicted and are released from custody. But the sheriffs here say, well, it's black letter. It says, you are a person, aren't you? Yes. You did get released from jail after being arrested for DWI, did you not? Yes. It says you're still registered within 10 days, right? Okay, on the 11th day, you're in violation, and they go out and arrest people for that, and they win convictions. We don't know the answer to this. We would have to have a precedential case to tell us exactly what the lawmakers meant by this language. And until we have that, the sheriff's guessing, I'm guessing, everyone's guessing, because we don't know.
All right. And then just over, this came in today, it was a comment on the Registry Matters website, and it comes from episode 181, a lifetime placement on the sex offender registry is unconstitutional. They said, that's great, but when will this law extend to all the states? I live in Hawaii, and I plan to use the South Carolina Supreme Court decision to challenge Hawaii's law. So when will the South Carolina law apply to Hawaii?
It may never apply to Hawaii.
So what should a Hawaiian do to help? Let me ask it more directly. Can he use the decision from South Carolina in his fight in Hawaii?
He could, but he may not have the same facts in Hawaii. What was compelling in South Carolina was that everyone is on for life and there's no opportunity for anyone to get off. I don't believe Hawaii has everyone on for life. Therefore, already as we start the litigation, we have a whole different scenario. Then Hawaii's registry may not be as debilitating. I can't know what restraints and disabilities are in existence in all the states. But we'd have to look at how disabling the registry is in one state and the fact how many people are on for life. If he is a lifetimer in Hawaii and there is no way off, there's no petition process in Hawaii, then he could cite to that, and it might be somewhat of persuasive authority, but the Hawaii Supreme Court is not obligated to follow that. That's not anything binding on them whatsoever.
Okay. So what you're saying, I think, in essence, is that South Carolina and Hawaii are different entities, different sovereigns.
Correct.
Okay. But because we are united, you wouldn't use any information from Canada or Mexico as any sort of statement to say, as any sort of precedence to say that you can do this. But if one of the states in the United States does it, it at least gives you some sort of legal ground that you should be, it should be something that you could bring up in another state within the 57, 8, 9 states in the United States.
You can argue it's persuasive authority if it's on point. It may not be on point because of what I just said. It may be that Hawaii doesn't have a lifetime registry for everybody. It may be that Hawaii already offers a petition off process. Those are what wrecked the train in South Carolina.
I gotcha. Okay, let's move on. I have another voicemail message, Larry, that was very cryptic. I don't know where it came from, but it was just maybe you got it from Narsal. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Let's hear it.
Okay. I was hoping you would set it up, but I'll just play it because it's kind of strange.
Hello, my name is Mark, and I would like to urge you to vote against the Supreme Court packing and the one where they'll take away all our guns. I think it's HR2171. Thank you.
That's super bizarre.
I wasn't sure which one you were going to play. That's why I didn't have any comment. That was a message that was received in my day job in the political arena that I work in. And that is an example of what we get. Now, I don't work for a United States senator. I work for a state senator. And so we get this message saying to vote against a really long resolution number that may even be too many digits about Supreme Court packing. And I have no idea what he's talking about. There's no voting to be done at the state level on the Supreme Court of the United States. There's no proposal in the state to enlarge our Supreme Court. But what's interesting to me is that all of a sudden, even though that person's not very well informed, there's apparently some undercurrent out there about court packing. And I think it's hilarious that the number has been at 9 for 150 years or so. That's not in our Constitution. That number's not fixed in the Constitution. Could it be possible, folks, just consider this, could it be possible that the reason why the number of cases that the Supreme Court decides each year has dropped so significantly since the 1960s is because of the complexity of litigation has changed so much since the 1960s? And could it be the age of the justices has gotten so advanced since the 1960s? Could it be that we actually need more justices to get the work done? I mean, could you open your mind for a moment and not have such skeptical ideas about this packing? It might be that it's time to expand the court after 150 years of it being at the magic number of 9. Maybe it's time for it to be at 13. Can we at least just have an intellectual discussion about what the judiciary needs in terms of resources?
I've heard a number of programs on this. There's nothing in the Constitution that says whether it's one judge, 9, 15, 38. There's nothing in there that says how many it is. It's up to us as the people to identify how many people there are on the court.
That is correct. But this is a scare tactic coming from the right, from the conservative side. And it's funny because they packed the courts for 4 years, including the Supreme Court. And now all of a sudden they're concerned about what they did of packing. But I wouldn't view it as a packing. I would look at the data. I would look at, is it time? Periodically, we expand the number of federal judgeships through, I think, in the Carter administration and then in the George H.W. Bush, there were a significant number of expansions of the number of federal judges in those two presidencies. And as the nation grows, we need more judgeships. If we continue to arrest and we continue to have the same amount of litigation for a greater population, you can't run those cases through a stagnant number of judgeships. It could be that it's time to enlarge the Supreme Court. Folks, keep your mind open. It might be that this is the right thing to do. Don't assume just because it's someone calls it packing that it's for sinister reasons. It may be for legitimate reasons.
And just to pile on top of that, though, Larry, even if they did pack it and make it 400 liberals on the Supreme Court, that does not make the Second Amendment go away. You would still need it to go through legislation and then get ratified by the states. It would take beyond an act of Congress to remove the Second Amendment.
Well, that's true, but you could interpret the Second Amendment differently. It was up until recently, until the Heller decision, that there was an individual right in the Constitution for firearm ownership. It had been interpreted that was for militia. The Supreme Court in Heller decided that you had an individual right. So the interpretation of the Constitution can change, and that's what they fear. They just know that people are coming for their guns. Of course, no one's coming for their guns, but they believe that.
I haven't heard anybody say it in those direct terms. Talk about controlling it to some degree, more background checks to keep it out of certain people's hands, but I haven't heard anybody say we're going to come round up the 300 million guns in the United States.
It would be a task. It would be impossible. You'd have a shootout if you tried, so you can't.
Right on.
Ready to be a part of Registry Matters? Get links at registrymatters.co. If you need to be all discreet about it, contact them by email, registrymatterscast@gmail.com. You can call or text a ransom message to 747-227-4477. Want to support Registry Matters on a monthly basis? head to patreon.com/registrymatters. Not ready to become a patron? Give a 5-star review at Apple Podcasts or Stitcher. Or tell your buddies at your treatment class about the podcast. We want to send out a big heartfelt support for those on the registry. Keep fighting. Without you, we can't succeed. You make it possible.
Play this voicemail and then we can go do what would be our feature of this memo from Judge Mach for Michigan. Is that right? But I'll play this voicemail before we hit that.
Yeah, hi. I'm recalling about questions regarding the sheriff requiring specific performances on the part of registrants that are not part of the law, such as photographs every month, etc., and then publishing pictures and whatnot that are not part of the law. So, like, is a community caretaking, is that, would that be an exception? That is my question, and how can I, is there going to put up a sign and trespass my property without a warrant? And I'm thinking Caniglia last year would tell them no, they can't do that. Thank you guys, FYB.
I had a pretty extensive conversation with this person about what is FYB, and I was like, no, it's FYP. And I tried to get him to circle himself around and figure out what FYP means without telling him, and we couldn't get there. Have you ever heard of this case called Caniglia? I have not.
I have not either. I think that would be a stretch of the caretaker doctrine to put signs in people's yard. But as we've said many times, they can do anything until they're stopped, right?
That seems to be how it goes.
We had two lawsuits in two separate counties in Georgia for sheriffs who were putting signs up on Halloween, the day before Halloween, say no trick-or-treating here. There's nothing in Georgia law that prohibits people forced to register from having trick-or-treaters, but the sheriffs decided they were going to do that, and they were stopped by litigation, at least temporarily. One of the counties agreed to a permanent injunction and settled, and the other county took it all the way, and it's still in litigation. It's at the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals. And they initially lost, and then they turned that loss into a victory. And now we're trying to overturn their victory and win that case on appeal. But the answer to the question is, yes, they can do that, not legally. But when have law enforcement needed legal authority to do things? I think we saw that on the episode early in the podcast. I don't think he had any lawful authority to extinguish a person's life, but he did.
He definitely did. And that... So this is an individual that I don't remember how much detail we went into, but the whole thing where we had the realtor on a couple months ago was prompted by this individual moving in from another state and trying to, he was very forthcoming with his PFR status, and they changed the rules. They like pulled the rug out from underneath him. And it looks like the county that he is moving to in a different neighborhood is going, like he called and told them that he's moving into the area, and they said, hey, we're going to put signs up during Halloween and whatnot, and he's not really happy about moving into this area from that.
After the first experience with that county, for the life of me, I cannot imagine why he would insist on wanting to live in that county. Is it the same county?
I believe so. And if not, we're talking in the southeast corner of the state where, unless you made your way all the way up to Savannah, I think everything would be super... super similar as far as population and demographics and all that stuff.
So, yep, I can't explain it.
Okay. But you don't think that in his question about the what is the careness doctrine? Is that what he said?
The caretaker. I think it's a stretch of the caretaker doctrine to put these signs up. I mean, they can argue that and say they're doing it as a community caretaker, but that's really not how it's generally been interpreted. That's when you go check on someone, you get a welfare call. You know, we haven't heard from this person. We're worried about them. They're 72 years old. They're not answering their phone. And then the police will use the caretaker doctrine as a basis for going on the property and entering the property, opening a door to see if it's unlocked, going in, checking on the person. Okay. And they do that without a warrant because they're not intending on intruding on the person. They're trying to keep the person safe. Now, the problem with the caretaker doctrine is when they see stuff in plain view while they're in there.
Okay. So maybe like a big pile of cocaine sitting on your coffee table?
Yes, then they'll go back and get a warrant. They will say that they were using the caretaker doctrine to be in your dwelling. They'll secure the place. They'll make sure that nobody enters or leaves, and they'll go back and use the probable cause, which will be just fine because they were entering legitimately. And they'll say that they have reason to believe that they're, because they found all this powder, and it's based on their training and experience, it's probably illegal. And then they'll be granted the warrant. Then they'll come take it, run it through the lab, and they'll arrest you for what they saw, that they were in your dwelling for trying to keep you safe.
I gotcha. Then Larry. So, okay, let's cover, like, oh, never mind. So the feature segment, I had it wrong about saying Michigan. Something else. I'm recalling something wrong. But you people put in a case from the Supreme Court. I did hear about this on the news, of this girl that made some interesting Snapchat posts, and it's called Mahoney Area School District versus BL, and that is a minor, by and through her father, Levy et al. Look, Larry, I read all 42 pages, and I even read Justice Thomas's dissent. He was the only Supreme Court justice that dissented, and I don't have a single idea why you are wasting our time on this incredibly expensive FYP production to produce. Why are you wasting our time with this? What does this have to do with our issue?
Well, a public high school student used and transmitted her Snapchat to her Snapchat friends vulgar language and gestures criticizing the school and the school's cheerleading team. And she was a bit disappointed because she didn't make the varsity team as a freshman. And as the court noted, the minor BL did not accept the coach's decision with good grace, particularly because the squad coaches had placed the an interim freshman on the varsity team. So that's what this case is about.
She just has her feelings hurt because they put someone else on, and I guess she's thinking that she deserves to be on. I'm better than that person, and I should have made it on the team. I guess that's really, like, well, the nexus for her making these posts.
Correct.
And so the student took place out of school hours and away from the school campus. In response, the school suspended her for a year from the cheerleading team. But since we are not in the cheerleading business, what does this case have to do with us?
I don't know why you keep asking me that, because the Supreme Court was faced with a significant First Amendment issue, which does impact our cause, depending on the issue that's raised. The Supreme Court had to decide whether the Court of Appeals for the Third Circuit correctly held that the school's decision violated the First Amendment.
All right, I need you to dig a bit deeper. What did she do exactly?
Well, based on what I read, it said she used her smartphone to post two photos on Snapchat, which allows users to post photos. I don't use Snapchat, but that's what it says. And they disappear after a period of time. The first image posted showed a middle finger raised, and it bore the bore the caption FU school and FU softball and F cheer, F everything. the second image was blank, but for a caption which read, "Love how me and another student got told we need a year on JV before we make varsity, and that doesn't matter to anyone else." The caption also contained an upside down smiley emoji, and I don't know what the significance of that is, and other Mahoney area school students and some who belong to the cheerleading squad, I guess, found these Snapchat photos, and that's what happened. This F stuff, people can figure out what the F bomb is without us saying it.
I imagine so. I really, really want to say it really badly, but maybe that would cause us grief on the other side. But so there's a whole bunch of F words and school, softball, and cheer, and then everything on top of it. I don't get the blank one with the upside down emoji. Like, who would get upset about just having an upside down emoji that they didn't make varsity? I don't get that part. But it did say that, according to the opinion, that at least one of her Snapchat friends took pictures of it. Pay attention to that part, Larry. So Snapchat things are supposed to expire after some number of seconds, and they're gone. But some of the people at her school grabbed screenshots of it. So maybe they do disappear from the application, but people can capture them for longer. It's important to remember these things. So some other members of the cheerleading squad captured them. One of the students who received these photos showed them to her mother, who was a cheerleading squad coach, and the images spread. Several cheerleaders and other students approached the cheerleading coaches, visibly upset about the posts. As a result, the school suspended her from cheerleading for a year. How does a case like this get to the Supreme Court? That is actually a really good question. Like, who cares about high school cheerleaders and the Supreme Court? Like, how do those two things intersect?
Well, because she had a German father, and after he exhausted all administrative remedies, he filed a case in federal court challenging the school board's decision.
Because she had, like, what right does she have? I'm trying to see the angle of what right does she have to be on the cheerleading squad, and they didn't squelch her speech. She just had consequences for her speech. Can we go there for a minute?
Sure.
So she doesn't have a right to be on cheerleading squad at all, and her actions have consequences. So her speech wasn't squelched; she just suffered a consequence for it.
Well, the question was that consequence justified, and that's what this decision's all about.
Okay, and so her dad did make a proverbial federal case out of it. I noted that the case was decided on motion for summary judgment, Larry, and you always bellyache about summary judgments and pontificate. The cases should be tried to let all the facts get discovered. It sure seems that summary judgment was adequate in this instance. It certainly worked in their benefit for the girl and her father.
Well, it did indeed work for the student. Unfortunately, it was not so good for the school. And let me quote from the opinion on page 10. BL spoke under circumstances where the school did not stand in loco parentis, and I can explain that later. And there's no reason to believe that BL's parents had delegated to the school officials their own control of BL's behavior at the Cocoa Hut. Moreover, the vulgarity in BL's post encompassed a message of expression and BL's irritation with and criticism of the school and the cheerleading communities. Further, most importantly, the school has presented no evidence of any general effort to prevent students from using vulgarities like the F-bomb outside the classroom. Now, remember, in summary judgment, there was no trial, so evidence was lacking in this case. Now, retrospectively, if the school board had contested the summary judgment, possibly. But let's just keep going. But right now, that's what happened. There was no evidence.
But for me, Larry, like a light bulb is going off that she suffered consequences, and then they fought it. But it made it all the way to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court said, "No, you guys can't do that." I see in the next paragraph that the court noted that the school argued that it was trying to prevent disruption, if not within the classroom, then within the bounds of the school-sponsored extracurricular activity. But we can find no evidence in the record of the sort of substantial disruption of a school activity or threatened harm to the rights of others that might justify the school's action. That would be the example of if you say the big B word, B-O-M-B, in a theater, you're probably going to incite some sort of chaos and confusion, and that's why you can't say it. I guess you have the right to say it, but there will be consequences for it, and that's the level of disruption that they're looking for here. So and since there was no trial, the school was not able to really put forth any evidence of disruption impact of BL's posting. So what do you think the school should have done when BL moved for summary judgment?
Well, in my opinion, I remember we're looking through the rearview mirror, but since I have the general belief the cases should be fully developed, they should have objected when BL moved for summary judgment, and they should have told the judge that there were material facts in dispute. Because I'm fairly certain that BL's attorney would not have been willing to stipulate that the speech had been disruptive to the school. And since they would not have made that stipulation, there would not have been any evidence to support the school's assertions in their pleadings. But had you gone to trial, and if they had in fact had witnesses to testify a disruptive effect had occurred, then they might have had a different outcome. But remember, they didn't object to summary judgment, apparently. I don't know for sure, but they probably didn't, because they thought that since the schools generally win these cases, as was expected in Smith versus Doe, because everybody knew that you couldn't apply anything retroactively, but actually you can. The school probably felt confident they were going to win this case, but they didn't.
Hmm. And can we really drill into this? Is there any parallel to our issue, and will this case support us?
The case does show that I was wrong, that the current Supreme Court is only concerned about corporate speech, because I said that on a podcast one time. Clearly, this case shows that they're consistent in supporting an individual's right to speak as well. Unfortunately, I'm not really certain of how helpful this case will be for our cause. Here we have a school restricting the content of what a student said. That is known as a content-based restriction. content-based restrictions are the most problematic from a constitutional perspective. And we have a direct action by the government since it was a publicly funded school. In our case, we're not fighting content-based restrictions. We're fighting access-based restrictions. The social media providers are placing limitations on access to their platforms, which is distinguishable. First, it's not the government imposing the restriction. Second, it's not a content-based curtailment of speech. And even if it were the government imposing the access ban, the legal analysis would be different because there are alternative means of speaking. And a content-based restriction is saying you cannot say these words. And that's what the school was telling her. You can't do the F-bomb. You can't put the middle finger up. You can't express yourself this way. And that's different from saying you can't use this particular vehicle to express yourself.
Could you make a parallel to, as an employee of a company, that they, to some degree, monitor your social media behavior, because you're, to some degree, a representative of that company, even for the one person that you work for? I'm sure he doesn't want you running around, ending up on videos running overnight of some sort of wild party going on. Like, that would represent him poorly. So he could say, I don't like how you act. I'm no longer going to have you employed here. Isn't that similar?
I believe that the school had compelling arguments. This was a tough case. And I believe that it could have gone the other way reasonably. Now, the 8-1 decision doesn't reflect that. But I believe it could have gone the other way, particularly if there had been a trial, particularly had they been able to show that there was a disruption. Because the Supreme Court did say that even off campus, that speech that's disruptive, bullying, certain types of speech can be curtailed. But absolutely, when you're wearing the uniform of the Dallas Cowboys or pick your team, what you do when you're, everybody knows you. And absolutely, the Cowboys could say, we don't want you representing us that way, I would think.
Yeah. Do you think that this case helps us in any way?
It might in the right circumstances. We would have to show that the government, or an extension of government, has prohibited a PFR from speaking particular words, not just that the PFR is having difficulty being heard speaking due to a social media imposed ban. The government has to be doing the prohibition, and they have to be, if this case is going to help, they have to be particular words that are being banned. And I'm not sure that that's happening in the current state anywhere. I don't know of any PFRs being told you can't say this or that.
Interesting. Anything else before we let this one go?
No. Are we going to do this other segment or just hold it over to next week since our guest lost power?
We're going to have to. He got an estimated time of turning the power back on, and he's. It'll be 9:30 Eastern, so that's another hour and a half from now before his power will come back on.
Well, we could do a abbreviated version or just do this again next week with the segment we had planned for him.
Yeah, I've asked him to see if he can be on next week. Is there anything else? I have a question that I want to ask you about a patron, but I have a couple other documents here. Is there anything else that you wanted to go over before we go to that?
No, I'd be glad to try to help with a patron. We always want to help our patrons, particularly this one.
Yeah, so I got a text message. I think it was Friday morning, and it says something to the effect of locked up. Come to the county jail where I am and pick up my keys and my wallet and phone. And I was like, oh crap. So this is a friend of mine that got out in November. And like, this is a key point, Larry. And so forgive me. I'm going to ask you for like quote unquote pseudo legal advice, but I know that you're not a lawyer, but I'm asking you for strategy. Cause I need to like, let this person know what's possibly going to happen to him. He has a parole violation from Texas. He did an interstate compact over there, and something happened there within a month. They're super strict. They're super jerks over there, and they revoked the rest of his parole, and he did another two or whatever years. So he gets out at Thanksgiving, and there was a phone left over from that time, and they found an image. And all I know about the image, it was, as far as I know, it's an adult nude image, and probation doesn't want you to have any sort of material like this. They came in. And it was, you know, like six cops deep. They roared in with the cars, lights blaring, whatever. And they come, toss the house, and they look at the phone, and they find this image. And this is now a probation violation. And so he's been taken down to his county of origin. And I guess in the handful next coming days, he'll hear from his probation officer what's going to happen and what they're going to do with him and recommend, I guess. And then I guess he goes before a judge and then they decide whether they're going to revoke some time or send him home or what. Like, what happens next?
Well, normally there are two steps to probation revocation. There's a preliminary revocation hearing to see if it can be worked out without a full-blown evidentiary hearing and factual development. Oftentimes, on minor violations, the probationer will go ahead and concede that they did the violation with some sort of understanding of what the outcome will be. You're going to get time served and remitted to probation, and sometimes a small amount of incarceration. To the extent that I give legal advice, and I can't in this case because I'm not under the supervision of a Georgia attorney, but to the extent I give legal advice, I would tell anyone that there's no reason to admit to a violation if you don't know what the outcome's going to be. If you're going to have to take your chances, why do you want to hand your head to them on a platter? I mean, that's just common sense. Okay. So what you're going to want to do is get you a good attorney that works in that jurisdiction. You do not need somebody come in with all guns blazing as an outsider and going to play heavy-handed. He's already at a disadvantage. He's already had a sustained violation of supervision while he was out of state. It was a different type of supervision. It was parole, but still he's already had a sustained violation. They can bring that into this, and they can say that this is part of a pattern. His best argument, from what little I know, would be related to the fact this is an old phone, and if he could show forensically that this photo dates back way previously, that it's not anything new, that it's not anything since he dealt with and extinguished his last violation, that could carry some weight. I'm not a forensics expert. We would have to hire someone.
Okay.
That could determine when the image got there. I don't know if you can even determine if the image has been viewed or anything like that. All that's above my pay grade. But the best thing is a well-connected attorney in that county that can go talk to those people and find out how much blood they want. You need to be able to sit down and say, hey, this guy, he has this image. It's not all that provocative. What do you want to do about this? Can we come to an agreement? That's what he needs to do.
And that's something I don't know. I don't know if it's a legal image, as in an adult. I don't know if it's a minor image. He says he told me where it was, and his description is of it being an adult image, but I don't know. And it is an old phone, so I'm really fearing the worst, that they're gonna give him some time, whether that's just a year or two, or he has 7.5 years of paper left. They could put the screws to him, Larry, and give him another. He's already done 12. They could say, why don't you go sit down for another 6 years or something?
But see, there's so much we don't know about this case. We don't know how bad that they want to get him in that county. From what I do know, you told me he's not connected at all, which he doesn't have any favors to call in. And being an outsider, that hurts him because they can be hard on him and there's no one that they have to answer to. But on the other hand, you, with a well-connected attorney, even though he doesn't have anything, that attorney can persuade them. Attorneys can be very charming. I mean, I'm not going to reveal every trick of the trade, but there are ways to convince prosecutors to back off and to be more reasonable. So that's why it's important he have an attorney who deals with this district attorney's office.
I will tell you, he's super anti-attorney because he spent a bunch of money in Texas and got a pretty crappy outcome. There's so many other variables in there, but he spent like 20 grand on an attorney then and still got his parole violated, revoked, whatever. So he's not real keen on going to spend any money on anybody else because he's already got a bad taste in his mouth.
Well, but the situation was different in Texas. He was there as a guest. And Texas, all they had to do was establish a minimum, very low showing of probable cause, a very low showing that he violated supervision. And then
is that because he was out of state or because he was on parole?
Because he's out of state and because he's on parole. But Georgia ultimately decided what to do with him. Texas only made the threshold showing that he had likely violated probation. There was probable cause to believe he violated probation and or parole, and that he would have been, that would have been significant had he been a Texas offender. Georgia decided what to do to him. Texas didn't have any control over how much time he did when he got to Georgia. They only sent him there. Georgia dealt with that. Same thing is going to happen here.
Texas said you can no longer be a guest here.
That is correct. When you go on interstate compact, you agree that you're going to abide by their rules, and they can add rules to what the state that sent you there. If you don't like that, when they hand you that paper that says you will accept special conditions, you tell them, look, I will not accept any special conditions other than what my court and my state imposed. You can tell them that.
And you can say that, and they'll say that you can't come here then.
That is correct. That's what they'll do. But you don't have to accept any condition you don't like.
So from that violation, then he gets sent back to his county of origin here and goes before a judge, and they decided to revoke some time. And that could be the same outcome again.
Well, if he doesn't come to an agreement, then there will be a full-blown hearing. If he says, I'm not admitting to anything, then the state will have to put on its case of what the violation is and the evidence that supports it. It's a different evidentiary standard. There's a relaxed rules for admissibility of evidence. It's not the beyond a reasonable doubt standard. It's more likely than not. You know, it's kind of like the preponderance of the evidence standard. And he will have a judicial hearing with a lawyer presiding. The judge is a lawyer, and he will have representation in all likelihood. I don't think they'll let a revocation hearing go forward without an attorney, but he may have a public defender that may not put as much effort into it as a retained attorney. He cannot be sour on what happened in Texas and decide not to have representation in Georgia. That would be a foolish mistake.
Okay. I gotcha. It's terrible. It's terrible. Oh my God. All right. I think so. I've been communicating by email with our guest, and you know, it's like 1,000 degrees over in your neck of the woods. Did you know that it's really hot over that way?
Yes.
And he says the Pacific Northwest. So I don't know specifically where he is. And he said it's like super hot and they're doing rolling blackouts and they cut the power and it won't be back on for another hour and change. So we will carry all of that content over and we will try and do this again if it's next week or sometime after that and get that individual on, get Matt, the outspoken offender on. What a mess. But I think we muddled through decently without that. And we are certainly at time anyway, Larry, that we would have had to almost cut that short. Also, but do you have anything else before we scoot out of here?
No. How do they support the podcast? We've got to get some more YouTube subscribers and some more patrons. So what do people do?
You know what? I'm going to press my little button on the video. Let's see so I'll turn off for the rotation thing and I'll go back to this one. It's like, wrong button. Where'd it go? There it is. So you can press the like and subscribe button there on the YouTube channel. And that will help us get more people to know about us in all of the more ways. And you can reach us over at registrymatters.co. That is the website. Certainly call in and leave voicemail, as some people have done, at 747-227-4477. The email is registrymatterscast@gmail.com. Now, Larry, one of the voicemails we played tonight was from someone that listens to the podcast that has utilized information from the podcast, but is not a patron. And it kind of chaps my hide a little bit that we are sending out information that people utilize and apparently are benefiting from, and then they don't come around and support the podcast. So go over to patreon.com/registrymatters and support the show. Any thoughts on that?
Well, I would hope that people would see the value, but apparently this individual didn't.
Makes me very sad. But Larry, I hope that you are able to stay cool, put on a wet rag on you, because it's dry out there, and I'm sure that helps a lot. If you're in the humid area, putting on a wet rag, you're kind of already living a wet rag.
Well, the heat wave, it's broken here. We're down to normal temperatures. It's only like 85, 90 here today.
Oh, only 85, not 105. Did you say it was 109 a week or so ago?
It was in 105 range, yeah. But that heat wave's broken. We're actually in a cooling spell for the next few days.
Oh, well, good for you. I think without anything else, Larry, then go over to YouTube and Twitter and all those other places, and you can subscribe and like and share all of our content. And I hope you have a great weekend, Larry, and thank you for all you do. I really appreciate it. Have a great night.
Thanks for having me back.
Always. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to FYP.